voice tape of a conversation with Mr. Wyatt T. Walker, March 18, Atlanta, Georgia. All right, sir.
Well, why don't you let me prime you?
All right. A question like this. To many people, it's astonishing that the leadership, by and large, of the Negro movement has come from the South, or has come from people living in the South at that time. How do we explain this? You have any theories about it?
Well, I don't know whether it's altogether geographical or no. I think there's a large degree of coincidence involved here.
Yes.
I think, as I'm sure everybody else has said, that the nonviolent thrust of the Negro community in the South that we've seen, say, within the last decade, has been a part of the history of the world, the rise of the nations in Africa toward independence. I think there's something about this moment of history which has caught this present generation.
It's just, I don't know. Not quite. Tavis has taken over a typewriting screen. You said it's a moment of history. One thing, the rise of the African states.
Yes, and I just think the Negro in the South, I think one of the biggest contributing factors to it is that we've come into a day of instantaneous communication. That one of the things that kept the Negro community in the Deep South insulated against even knowing something better to want was the fact he didn't have the information. There's an old expression, you can't miss what you never had. So this day of instantaneous reporting of news events has given the Negro a chance to connect himself up with the whole stream of history, in a sense. I think the other, well, another contributing factor is that in a very real way, the minds of Negroes have been unlocked, in a sense. For instance, I think the white Southern racist uses a lot of sophisticated arguments as to why the Negro is inferior and why there ought to be separate facilities and separate educational facilities, which are not at all the real reasons. I think the more insidious reason is that he has wanted to keep the Negro ignorant. You can't lay open a man's mind to the truth of the humanities, to the trend of civilization of the Western world over the last 500 years. You can't bait his mind in the thinking of Aristotle and Plato and Diogenes without him wanting something better in life. Maybe what I'm saying in short would be that to keep a man a slave, you've got to keep him ignorant. Unslave his mind and you unslave inevitably his person.
That's how Frederick Douglass put it.
Yes. I think if you, as you're making an analysis of Negro leadership, I think the people who hold the titular responsibilities, whether they have come by them out of design or by accidents in history, they are all people with finely tuned minds who have a sharp sensitivity to the humanities. They are generally literate and well-read men who do their own thinking. I think if you would make just a spot survey or spot check of the people with whom you've talked, this is the general stripe of people you've talked with.
That's true. This raises a question. In 1935, would such a leadership have been available among Negroes?
Well, I personally doubt it. I don't. It's difficult to second-guess history. I do not think it was possible in 1935, because a lot of what has been produced has come about out of the response to what World War II produced. You had a new temper developing. Our Negro boys who served in World War II got to see the world, in a sense, and they had made an investment in making the world safe for democracy, etc., all of the slogans we had. And they came back with certain questionings in their minds. They had been overseas and had freedoms that they never even conjectured in Mississippi and Alabama and Georgia and Louisiana. And then in their own minds say, well, if I fought and ran the risk of dying for all of America, then I ought to have some share of it here. The shift in the South had a lot to do it, from an agrarian economy to a urban industrial economy has had a lot to do with the groundswell of discontent in the Negro community. Negroes leaving the Deep South in droves and going to the large industrial cities in the North during the war. This is another ancillary force, I think.
What about the notion that we encounter sometimes that the Negro is just discovering his identity, that this is part of this whole movement?
Well, I think it's a very
discovering and accepting his identity.
Yeah. I think it's a very critical part, because I've seen in my own lifetime, I'm not an old man, as you know. I have been, as a child, I can remember being aware of an internal color discrimination in the Negro community. And being a mulatto, I guess I was sensitized to it, because I had brothers and sisters who, I don't know why, gave to being light-skinned some special value.
You mean some of your brothers and sisters did feel this?
Oh, yes, they felt, I know two sisters particularly, and one brother in particular, who felt that being a light-skinned Negro assigned to them some special values. I think, fortunately for me, I rebelled against this. Maybe this was my inquiring mind that I wasn't aware of it at an early age, and I rebelled against it. And I thought people were people on the basis of their intrinsic worth, the fact that they were humans. And I think this could have been one of the things that made me get the issue of humanity square in my own mind. I have seen that change sharply in the last 15 or 20 years. I have known dark-skinned people in whose presence I would be afraid to say the word black, seriously or humorously.
Now or in the past?
No, in the past, 15 years ago. Now I feel no reluctance whatsoever. In fact, it's a part of the built-in humor of this movement that we kid each other about it, you know, calling each other half-white Negroes and black Negroes. In affectionate terms, you know.
Some weeks ago, I was having an interview with a quite distinguished lawyer who's a Negro, and he was saying to me that it's a real problem for him living in a world of white symbolisms, symbolism of white and black, and dark and light, as value symbols. Mm-hmm. Through English poetry or French poetry or American fiction and God knows what, and in casual conversation. He said bitterly, I find myself schooling myself to invert these symbolisms that are hidden in all in literature and in common speech.
Yeah, I think it's symptomatic in the Muslim movement, you know.
This man's not a Muslim.
No, I know he may not be, but I this is the other extreme of
yes.
it. That within this movement, they are exalting black, which is the reverse of exalting white. And I can certainly sympathize with this lawyer, because I know when I'm watching television and reading stories, and in some of our expressions, maybe my antenna is out, you know, to pick up these little value assignments on the basis of color. You know, we talk about a little white lie. But a terrible lie is a black lie. I saw a television story about a good horse and a bad horse, and the good horse was white and the black horse was bad, you know. And it's so skillfully woven into the whole fabric of our value judgments that I think sometimes it almost happens to us unconsciously.
Now, let's think of this connection. These oppositions of light and dark run through all sorts of things in our society.
Oh, yeah.
In our literature. Well, it also is found in Africa.
Yeah.
This makes a change. Now, when you have African tribal dances,
well, I would qualify what I have said earlier by saying that you must understand, I'm sure perhaps you do, that this is the normal emotional response for the American Negro because of the frame of reference in which he has been forced to move.
Yes, yes.
Though it may not be, when you trace it to its historical origin, something that grows out of race or color prejudice, but because of the box in which the Negro has been moved, and this is his immediate interpretation of it.
He interprets it that way, though the symbolisms may, as some anthropologists say, antedate any contact with white European culture.
Yes.
As in Chinese theater, literally a face is darkened for the villain and whitened for hero.
Yes, well, I think this goes back even to Platonic dualism. It's reflected in the New Testament writings of Paul. He talks about the children of light and the children of darkness, and
there
which may
are.
Even go back to the business of day and night.
Day and night,
you
know, back to...
And with the primitive mind not really quite grasping what makes night and what makes day. And, of course, the night was unknown to him, and, of course, the beast of prey and all of the dangers of jungle life, I guess. This, it seems to me, this would probably be the origins and the roots of this.
Then we have a very strange situation, don't we, of a social, the conditioned attitude toward natural symbols.
I think one has been superimposed on the other.
On
We've
the
taken
other.
The natural symbols, and then as the structure of race and color concepts developed, we superimpose this on nature symbols that were already available.
There we are. Now, what reaction is appropriate then for, say, a cultivated Negro or a not cultivated Negro facing these symbolisms?
Well,
that's reasonable and logical.
Yeah, I would hope that I could be considered cultivated. But I don't think any Negro, no matter how much he's cultivated, ever really becomes emancipated. You know, no matter how much my mind has been opened, no matter how much academically I recognize the fallacy of race, so much has been done to my emotional pattern by what we call the system, segregation and discrimination, that I never really am free of it. And so you get, sometimes in fleeting moments, the reverse response, discrimination the other way. For instance, I think Negroes, like myself, have developed almost a mental catalog of the tone of voices of how a white face speaks to them, which in another circumstance, when a Negro speaks, it would get no response whatsoever. But everything that a white person says is interpreted by the nuance of the tone of voice, or maybe the hang of the head, or the depth of tone, or the sharpness of the tongue, you know. Things that in an ordinary, normal, ethnic frame of reference would have no meaning, takes on tremendous and deep and sharp meaning.
In other words, you are documenting the remark made by more than one Negro that to be a Negro is to have a touch of the paranoid.
Oh yes, I think we have almost a total ambivalence, even in this moment of history for the Negro, when he really accepts his identity more than he has ever had before. There's still a retention of this ambivalence, which has many roads by which it has come. Some of it came out of survival. Some of it came out of hatred for the white man. Just the pure joy of saying one thing that you knew he wanted to hear and really meaning something else, you know.
Even the folklore.
Yes.
Even Uncle Remus.
Yes, poking fun at the master without the master ever really understanding what he was saying. And this runs through the idiomatic expression of the Negro and the Negro spirituals and in Negro religion even.
What about this question, then, of the relation of white men to the Negro movement? We have very violent statements here and there. Baldwin says the white liberal is an affliction. Or others have said you have no more connection with the white sympathizer, the white liberal. He has no place. He's a curse. This is a logical... logical extension of that attitude, isn't it?
Yes, I agree.
Now, what is the role? What role can, say, the white man take toward...
Well, of course, I stand in the American nonviolent tradition as it is symbolized in Martin Luther King Jr., understandably so. I do agree with Adam Powell, one person whom I know has said this again and again, that the day has come when the white person has no role to play in the policy decisions of the Negro movement. But I do not go all the way with him to say that we do not need white allies. So maybe I'm a middle of the roader on this point of view. I say that there are some decisions that the Negro will have to make tactically and strategy-wise as far as the direction that his movement is going to take. And there are certain kinds of decisions in which I don't think a white man's attitude can have any impact whatsoever. And they ought to be left alone to the Negro community. But if he wants to help with our revolution, then he must come in and join with us. I think we have passed the... We have come through the stage of the Southern white liberal of 15 years ago. I have an expression I use about we are afflicted with outworn white liberals, or worn out white liberals, who 15 years ago, what they were saying could have cost them their life. But they're saying the same things now that they were saying 15 years ago, and as James Russell Lawless has said, time makes ancient good uncouth. So we are at a different moment in history.
Is it possible that the Negro movement could have success without a white consensus, though, in its favor?
Yes, I do think so.
Without the white consensus?
Yes.
How would you explain that?
Well, I know this is a minority opinion, but I sincerely believe it, that the Negro has just enough pivotal position in the economy of our nation, free enterprise system, and just enough visible identity that generally in a united effort we could produce so creative a crisis that the consensus in a sense might be forced. Not a consensus of consent, but a consensus prodded by practicality.
In other words, a rising political and economic force.
Yes. Strategically used and applied.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this coupled with, I would say, the guilt burden that the white community must bear, or that they do bear, particularly within the frame of reference of, shall we say, white Christianity or white religious life.
You mean you're coupling the question of guilt burden, which is another way of saying potentiality of consensus.
Yes, I suppose so. I
guess that's turning upside down.
Yes.
So in other words...
That you may not emotionally want to be ready to accept it, but you recognize intellectually that this is the proper thing.
Well, guilt's in the guts, though. If you have the feeling of guilt, you already have an awareness of a moral issue. A desire for another attitude in yourself. Isn't guilt the feeling of a desire for another attitude in yourself?
Well, I had not defined it as closely as that. For instance, this is the feeling that I was trying to get at, or that I'm referring to. When a white person says, I know what the right thing is to do, but I just don't have the power to do it.
It's an old story.
Yes.
For any complexion.
Yes, and I don't... That to me, that has not yet approached consensus.
Well, what action means consensus, but the potentiality of consensus lies, say, in a recognition of a responsibility.
Yes, I could buy that as the expression goes. We started down one lane once that I'm trying to recall. And I know I hadn't quite exhausted my nitpicking ideas about it.
Well, let's go back.
I believe it had to do with... I think it began with a question as to whether this... it had to do with the Negro accepting his own identity. And I remembered in my mind, I wanted to say a few more words about that because... I think this is half of the battle for the Negro to accept himself as he is. Now, maybe my philosophy or attitude about this is a little structured because I've talked about it a good bit from the public platform. But this business of this internal color discrimination, as I say, was very sharp 15 to 20 years ago when I was a youngster in high school. And I was very aware of it. And as I indicated, I have seen its sharp disappearance, you know. You do not find Negroes today who are light-skinned, who assign to themselves any special value. And you do not find its counterpart, the sharp sensitivity of Negroes who are dark-skinned. In fact, it has gone a little, the pendulum has swung a little bit the other way, that there's a little more pride being taken now in a Negro being a visible Negro, you know, where there's somewhere, you know, if you're on the borderline, like some of us mulattoes are, we feel a little bit embarrassed, kind of like we've been cheated, you know, in this movement of the rise of the nations in Africa and the respectability of being black and having kinky hair, you know. I think it's healthy, even though the pendulum has gone the other way, because I think the natural response is going to be it will even out. But I think more than anything else, this has given to the Negro, this is what the nonviolent movement has given to the Negro, a basic belief in his own personal worth, that no matter who he is, there is a means now by which he can make his witness for what he believes. Without cursing and swearing and cutting and shooting, you know, using any of the traditional violent means when one wants to react against oppression. He has found identity not alone for himself, but he's found identity with the group. The Negro has a new solidarity. This is true not only of one Negro with 100 other Negroes, but it's also true of Negroes south and north. I think Birmingham meant this more than anything else. There were many Negroes in the North who kind of felt sorry for those poor Negroes down south, but then didn't really feel a bond. But the bond has been forged now as never before.
In fact, there was, by all reports of sociologists and other observers, a great withdrawal on the part of Northern Negroes from Southern Negroes as they came north.
Yes, they wanted to cut off not only from the stark circumstances that they had left, but they also wanted to cut themselves off from their historical roots of having been slaves. I think this is reflected in another way in the middle-class Negro who begins to develop enough economic security that he wants to cut himself off from the Negro community. He finds himself unacceptable to the white community. And so his frustration is lost in, as I think Dr. King describes, conspicuous consumption, completely devoid of any spiritual or moral values, you know. And it has been a kind of entrapment that he has wandered into. I think it has been reflected in the early days, maybe even now in our present revolution, that a lot of the goals the movement have been directed toward have been, in a sense, middle-class goal. They are middle-class goals and not so much things that affect the simple and plain people of the land. But more and more, the center of the movement, the focus of the movement, is shifting, particularly in economic terms, to matters of employment, those things which are going to be the day-by-day flesh-and-blood considerations of the people of the land.
Moving away from civil rights as such, toward the economic substructure, the psychological substructure, is that it?
Yes, from civil rights to human rights, the right to be free from the fear of want and hunger and free from the fear of not having shelter, free from the fear of ignorance.
Cutting back a second on the matter of identity, we know long back, at least as far back as Du Bois, talk about the split in the Negro soul, the division of impulses, sometimes for some people, an almost irreconcilable division of impulse, one toward the extreme form Africa, toward the mystique noir, if you have it now, a negritude, or the notion of the Negro culture as separate from and antipathetic to and resisting all the white Western European Judeo-Christian culture. All this withdrawal, which is an extreme form, becomes a kind of black chauvinism of the Muslims, for instance. On the other hand, the impulse to enter into, to absorb and be absorbed by, and integrate with this other Western European cultural tradition, and perhaps lose the whole, even lose blood identity in this absorption. Does this split, is this for you a split of impulse?
No, I think this present movement that we have is going to lead toward a synthesis of the two.
Dr. King this morning was saying that he recognizes a real problem, you see.
Yeah. Well, I would...
There are very sharp divisions of feeling on this question, you see, in many ways of discussing it. I do hope you will discuss it now.
Yes. Now, I feel, as Dr. King does, that it is a problem. And maybe I'm going out on a limb by giving my own personal conjecture.
Well, please do.
I do not think the Negro in the foreseeable future is going to lose his ethnic identity, if that's the proper way to describe it. I think for 3 to 4 to 5, maybe 6 generations, there's going to be a visible Negro community. But I think the temper of history in the world, particularly with the rise of the African and Asian nations, is such that the color factor is going to recede in its importance. Now, I know this is perhaps... I don't think it's an undue optimism. And so I see here as a synthesis between the two, that color will become an incidental means of identification. And the Negro will find his place in America... in a very real sense, as the Jew has, as the Irish, as the labor movement, that the tide of history of our times is going to demand so much for human rights that the Negro will, in a sense, integrate himself into this new stream of history in such a way that he will not be lost visibly, but yet the stereotypes and the discrimination and the artificial obstacles that that hampered him in his first 100 years from emancipation will recede almost into insignificance.
As you envisage a pluralistic society in America rather than a unified society in that sense.
Yes, I think what we're going to see in America is what the world is like in miniature in one place. It's going to be... kind of United Nations, because even with the restrictions being imposed on new people coming from other countries, I think we're still going to have them come. Some way is going to be found. The technological advances of this nation, the agricultural skills, our reputation, and our bent as builders, we get more out of the land. We have the largest leisure class, you know. It's going to be a mecca toward which people who have an opportunity are going to find their way. And I think you're going to have more of a melting pot in America. I envision something like maybe a larger Hawaii or a larger Jamaica, something like that. And I think this is my hope for America, that it will become like Jamaica. I was in Jamaica last year, and you could clearly distinguish Orientals and... English people of English stock, or European stock, I should say, some Americans, West Indians, and Negroes. But everybody had the concept, not that they were Jewish or English or Chinese or Oriental, or that they were Negro, but that they were Jamaicans.
What about the notion that we encounter that Negro, the American Negro, is more like the old white American than like anybody else, the old white Southerner, the old white Yankee?
Well, I don't think it's entirely true. I think we have to start with the basic premise that the Negro is an American. There is very little I think that we have been able to retain from our so-called African or jungle heritage, other than the blood lineage, which we naturally have to trace. By and large, if you take the Negro, 9/10 of him is a product of American culture. Now, because we have existed as a subculture in American society, we have become imitative of what we have seen, and in many instances we are, as George Kelsey said, an exaggerated American.
That's the same idea, one aspect of it.
Yes, so in this wise, you see in the Negro merely a mimicry or an imitation of what he has seen in the rest of Americans who, out of a circumstance of history, have had privileged positions and our values and ideas reflected. So in this wise, I think it's true.
Have you read Faulkner's Intruder in the Dust?
Yes.
You remember that very ambiguous section about the Southern Negro and the Southern White and the theory of homogeneity, that they would represent somehow against an outside world?
Yes.
What sort of sense does that make to you, if any, or how do you interpret it?
Well, I don't think it's... I think here you have a reflection of the provincialism of a geographical provincialism that still pervades this day in the South. For instance, the South feels it stands against the rest of the nation politically and maybe in a real sense economically. I think this is to a large degree the same kind of thinking which caused us to have this Southern bloc in Congress. I don't think in practical terms it really works out like this. As I recall, vaguely, they were saying that the utopia of the South would be that the Negroes would go along their slow course to whatever their goals were, and the white people would go along their course to whatever their goals were. And in one Southern homogeneous setting, the two would exist separately but side by side.
Well, that isn't apparently what Faulkner meant, formal segregation. He meant something else, whatever he
something
meant.
Was voluntary.
Well, not voluntary segregation, not segregation at all.
Why not?
In Faulkner's work, segregation is not the point. Excuse me, I have to change the tape here. This is the end of tape one of the conversation with Mr. Walker. See tape two.